Hello, everybody, and welcome to B2B Craftworks, a podcast about business writing. And today we get to hang out with Alyssa Greenfield even more.
I am excited for more.
I am too. I'm hearing a lot of really good feedback, even from people who have been in the space for a while. So I feel like maybe we're smart.
Maybe. I think that's for our clients to decide.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. And that's actually the topic for today, because I think one of the things I've really admired about your career, even though the freelance part has only been like 2 years, right?
Yeah.
It's like you came in so quickly and just knew who you wanted to work with. And maybe there was some figuring that out in the beginning, but whenever you talk about it now, it's just, I don't like that. Or yes, I'm very excited. I like that. And I feel like some people don't have that kind of clarity. Mm-hmm. I want to dig in and find out where you got that.
All right. Did not happen overnight, I will tell you that.
Okay. So then I want that part of the story. So when it comes to like culling clients and figuring out who you actually like to work with, that was a process?
That was a process. It was one of those things that felt like a long process at first. And then I realized, oh, I figured that out in 9 months to a year. I'm doing this work. I'm not always good at that perspective. I'm like, oh, that actually didn't take that long. But the reason I figured that out so quickly is because I tried to prove to myself that I could make more money than I did at my full-time job. And I was just like, I'm going to show them that I can make this work. And I took on everything that came my way. And some of it was amazing. And some of it was absolutely soul crushing. And a lot of it was just in the middle of, okay, I'm surprised they're willing to pay me this because it's not that difficult. And they're a really nice client who I would be happy to be friends with. And a lot of that. But I had this one client who I absolutely loved, their story, why they wanted to do the work, the process, the impact of that work. And I got very clear when I left my full-time job that the reason I could not be there anymore was that I couldn't make the impact that I really needed to make to feel like I was doing important work. And so that was always just out of reach. And as soon as I got that first client where I could see these amazing ripple effects of the work we were doing together, a client that was willing to roll up their sleeves, be a partner in this, understood the value, I could see the reactions that they were getting to the content that you're posting. This is it. This is the type of work I want to do. This is the type of client I want to work with. I'm going to go all in. And it took a while to, I started planting those seeds. It probably took another 9 months or so just to see the results. So that, it was not overnight. I had to build a lot of trust with the new audience. And I'm still working on that in some ways. But I just got so clear that's what I wanted to do.
Interesting. That feeling that this is too easy, I can't charge so much for it. That's interesting. That's a whole mindset thing.
Yeah. Mind you, I didn't question it. So that was also a more established company. I knew they had the money. It was great for them to be able to offload this work versus now I work with startups. So it's a little bit more, I don't know. I know that every dollar is precious to them. So it's just a different yeah. Like when they're willing to pay a certain amount for the work, it really shows that they understand the value of it.
Yeah, I really like that nuance because I'm not sure people always grasp the difference between working with differently established companies. How would we put that? Because it's not quite their revenue or size or time in business, but I get that feeling too from startups where it's like each dollar is more tied to survival than not. Whereas with mm-hmm. other businesses, like all of the money in the budget is important. But for a startup to invest in something, it's like they're really placing their bets on that. Like that's a gamble. Every investment is a gamble for a startup. Maybe that's what I'm thinking. So for them to spend it on thought leadership, that's a belief in it.
Yeah. And I didn't realize until we started talking about this truly just now that Yeah, working for a company that was 100 years old and had really big marketing budgets and really everything budgets. And even in rough years, had way bigger of a budget than any startup I've ever met. If they say, okay, you can spend whatever, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 on some initiatives. Okay, cool. It doesn't feel personal. It doesn't feel like there's that much at stake. When an early stage, really any stage startup says that to a freelancer or a consultant, you're like, okay, you're going to be like, yeah.
This matters.
You're going to be expecting something.
Interesting, because I feel like I might not have cared about making an impact for a long time. It probably took me 5 years to actually feel like I needed to get that out of the work I was doing. Because at first it was very much just, can I make the same amount of money doing this as I did teaching and then in government contracting and then marketing? And so it really was just, where can I use these skills that I love of writing and like slowly increase the value? And I want to say like maybe year 5 or 6, that's where I'd written so much that I started to actually care. Does this matter to the company? Does this change anything about what they're doing, having this conversation or publishing this piece of content?
Yeah. So what was your first or second year trying to make as much as you were making before?
It was the same kind of hamster wheel, not a golden hamster wheel, more like a stainless steel hamster wheel that needs to be cleaned, where it was kind of like $35 an hour podcast transcription and really just getting in with marketing companies that knew the value of marketing because they were doing it, but they also undercut that value because they were doing it. So they were like very aware of how much time or how much effort something would take. And so I just gathered maybe 3 or 4 marketing companies from around the world, or I mean, around the US, that needed that. I expanded internationally when I found a bicycling coach who like coached other people on their elite bicycling. And so I would edit the translated blogs from that. That was super fun. That was my first international.
Very cool. Okay.
Figure out. It was like measuring the amount of protein you were eating and like how to improve your kilometer time, like things like that. It was wild. But people paid him a lot for bicycle coaching. So he had that budget to put into like marketing content. It was wild.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah, just a lot of that. And then I bumped into Jonathan Stark and that idea of project pricing. And so I switched from 35 an hour to 75 a blog post. And that was the big transition that I made. And then slowly went to 125, 150, 250, 375, just worked my way up through that. So it was a lot of writing. It was maybe 1 to 2 deadlines a day for a couple of years of like shorter blog posts and stuff like that. Yeah, so it was grueling.
Oof.
But also fun, because that feeling of getting paid for writing is still... very little comes close to that. It's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. And I'll think about it sometimes. I wanted to go to school for journalism and I'm looking at that career. I went to Borders bookstore and looked at the book of different careers and majors. And I was like, oh, journalism, $30,000 a year. That sounds great, because I had no sense of money. And then I'm definitely doing better than that.
Same. My mom warned me against being a teacher, like so gently and so consistently. And she was like, they really don't make a lot of money. And in my mind, I was like, that's fine. I don't need a lot of money. I'll just be super happy. And then it's a horrible job and you don't make money. It's not a good deal right now.
Yeah. Although I was, not to go on too much of a tangent, but I was in New York City this weekend with a couple of girlfriends, and we were getting our nails done, and there were 2 women who did not know each other, but they were both school teachers. And it was this interesting mix, like they immediately connected, but it was this interesting mix of like absolute exhaustion, but also really proud of the work they were doing. I think one of them had been doing it for 12 years and one of them was a little bit earlier on in her career. But I think teaching any career, especially being a business owner, a freelancer, a consultant, wherever you want to call us, I think there's this interesting conversation that you have to have with yourself around what is most important to me. Is it the money? Is it the lifestyle? Is it the balance? Is it the types of clients? Like, because otherwise, I'll just keep having that experience I had in my first year where I just want to prove that I can make a certain amount versus starting with, okay, why? How much do I need? What's important to me? What are my expenses? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, because we can get really abstract by saying money, but money really means security. And then if you start to look at what's the actual number I need to feel secure, and that number would just never be satisfied. It's always twice whatever you have now. So it's, if you chase that, it just goes and goes. And I think it's tricky. I tend to specialize with people who are on the verge of a mental breakdown from their career. When I think of teachers, I don't really think of the ones who have just committed to the grit and they're like in it for life. They couldn't imagine anything else. It's more like people who it just didn't turn out the way they thought it would. And so they're on the edge of survival and not making money and they just got to get out. Like that feeling comes up a lot. So figuring out like, what does money actually mean? Especially for me, maybe that feeling of achieving my goal and hitting these goals of 100K, then 200K. I think last year I finally put my taxes together and it was 250 with coaching and institute stuff thrown in there. But if it leads to a lifestyle of feeling burnt out and working nights, and if you have any thoughts that aren't related to work, it feels weird, that's probably not a good place to be either. So in my mind, I'm working on like coming down off that mountain and reducing expenses and not trying to earn less, but at least earning enough, or like wondering what enough is, especially as far as how much of your day is spent working. What's enough with that? And if it hits below a certain point, then I feel weird. So is that good to feel weird because you work too little? Or is that not healthy either? So I don't know. It's all a mix. Okay. So meaning and impact was one of the things you're looking for. Were there any other factors that you like looked for or started to pick up on as you found clients that were better fits?
At some point, probably about a year ago, so roughly a year, maybe a year and a few months into being a business owner, I felt like I was not winning a lot of the proposals that I had put out. And so I decided to put all of my leads into a spreadsheet and color code it and just say, okay, this one is like out there, I'm being ghosted, or just, I don't think anything's going to come of this. This one happened. This one, they outright said, no, it's not the right fit for us. And once I saw that, I started to realize that the ones that didn't go through were clearly not the right fit. They cared much more about, what is your project or retainer rate break down to hourly? But one reason or another, it just became so clear that long term, we would not be a fit. Even short term, we probably wouldn't have been a fit. And I started to realize that the ones that did go through, they were really no brainers. It was much less about what's the expected ROI of this work, or what are the exact deliverables, and being really nitpicky about things. It was much more based on a feeling. We would get on to that discovery call, that initial call, and we would just have a conversation. And it was like, you clearly hear that I had these challenges, Alyssa. You have navigated this before. Just like, you're listening to what I'm saying and you're asking thoughtful questions, and we're going back and forth, and we're connecting as humans. Because I'll tell them, like, listen, if you want to do a test month, great, because we're going to be true like thought partners in this work. I do pretty exclusively thought leadership at this point. If we're not comfortable with each other, that dynamic isn't there, the content's going to suck. And it's going to be a really tedious process for one or both of us, probably both of us. And I don't want you to pay me long term if we can't build that relationship, if it's not like this two-sided thing, because ultimately, like, I'm ghostwriting content for you. It's your voice. I need to better understand that. I really started looking for the ones where those conversations early on felt easy. Felt like we were partners from the beginning. Felt like they understood that it wasn't about the optimal time to post something on LinkedIn or number of followers or anything related to performance. So that's great. I can give examples of clients that have had really great results. But yeah, it was much more of this feeling of, I have this story. I have these ideas. I want to get them out into the world. And I need a partner who can show up, have those conversations with me, help me make sense of the ideas in my head and get them out there. And once I really learned to focus in on that, I started finding more people who like got it. And the ones where I didn't, honestly, if I didn't leave a conversation feeling really excited about the work, probably it wasn't going to work out. Probably they weren't feeling excited either. And then probably they were just going to ghost me because they couldn't put their finger on the fact that it wasn't the right fit, or they didn't want to admit to me that it was the right fit. So they would.
Okay. I'm hearing a lot of like feeling around in the dark for the right fit. And then it's if you can grasp another hand, then it seems to work out, because on both sides, you're trying to figure out what the work is going to be. And this is so important for people moving into this space to understand, because what you just described is how a writer navigates past the idea that you're an SEO content writer, past the idea that you're a social media specialist or anything like that. Like, it's not about the SEO keywords or the metrics and the ROI on social media. Like, it really is deeper and more connected to the business's like reason for being, in essence, like that idea that needs to come through in their marketing. And I feel like that's what people miss when they get into thought leadership is it SEO? Is it LinkedIn? Is it like they're trying to figure out what it is? And it's just this deeper, more mysterious thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And we could talk about SEO for like hours, but yeah, I have anytime someone has just been so tied up in frameworks or best practices or metrics, we're probably not going to get along super great.
And I think that is the source of my non-SaaS tirade, because it seems like SaaS is much more tied into those things all the time. Yeah. I'm always trying to defend myself why I moved away from SaaS.
I think that and it's probably this like self-defense mechanism in some ways, though I do love the way that I've like the types of clients I've gone after. I work directly with founders in most cases, not at the company level. So I'm telling their stories, and it's maybe a half a level removed from company marketing, or even more than that.
Yeah.
And so that's a really nice way to be like, all right, your marketing team can worry about that stuff. I can check in with them occasionally and make sure the things we talk about are loosely aligned to what your marketing priorities are. But ultimately, this is about a person showing up and sharing their stories. And yes, it's going to tie into the company because this person is the founder of the company in most cases, or co-founder. But yeah, that's my way of, I think, steering clear of some of those conversations that I didn't necessarily do on purpose, but I am thoroughly enjoying that I'm largely removed from some typical marketing conversations.
I'm nodding vigorously. Yeah. So I wonder, that kind of brings us to like ideal format and type of writing. How did you figure out like the LinkedIn or the, what kind of writing do you do? We could talk about that.
Yeah. I've done so much at this point. I had a little bit of a fear that I was going to get pigeonholed into being somebody who writes LinkedIn content for startup founders and some VCs now. But I kind of love starting there because it's this great, you and I both post a good amount on LinkedIn. And I feel like we're tinkerers, experimenters with content there. And it's a nice low risk way to try out different ways of telling stories, of sharing ideas, of you have lots of like quick snappy things, but also longer stories, I think more and more. And it just is low pressure, a great way to get a lot of ideas out and see what resonates and then learn from that for other types of content. So I do a lot of LinkedIn now, and I've accepted that I'm not going to get pigeonholed. It's just going to be like, if LinkedIn were to go away, I have built that relationship with the client around this specific type of content. And then we can say, okay, I've helped clients write books. I've helped clients with blogs. I've helped clients with like emails, whatever it might be. I can pull from a decade plus of corporate experience and say, okay, we can pivot as long as it loosely relates to storytelling and the founder or entrepreneur first versus company first.
It sounds like it's so client driven that it's really whatever a certain type of client might need in their business environment.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because I'm a lot more content focused and it's more about filling out like that B2B marketing portfolio. So mostly white papers, some case studies, and then thought leadership that's in kind of a journalistic format.
Yeah.
That's been what's going on. Yeah. And as far as how I figured that out, it really was chasing the pricing, up the scale, basically. Like it's always been very money motivated for me.
Yeah. And it's figuring out. And we've had these conversations in the past, just, yeah, figuring out that right balance. And just for me, I think the more types of content I bring into the mix or the more I strayed from thought leadership, the more like overwhelmed I got. I feel like you figured it out in a much clearer way than I have. I think my response to all the different like types of client switching and project switching and having proposals that started out with multiple types of content, which is, no, I don't want that. I just want very straightforward. And even now, if I find myself in proposal conversations that are less defined or just like many different formats of content, I get overwhelmed to say we're going to have regular interviews and communication and we're going to have this many LinkedIn posts and we can grow in the future. But yeah.
Interesting.
I struggle with the, I don't know, like flexible scope sometimes.
Yeah, I think it came from my teaching background of laying out what was happening and making rubrics and frameworks for things. So it was always like, I want to very clearly define what people can expect from me. Because if you told me somebody could just call me once a week, that would freak me out. I need to know when and where and what I need to prepare for it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just an interesting, like everyone builds their business so differently. And I think the faster you can figure out like who you are as a person and what's not going to completely wear you out, the better. And the faster you can figure out that there's not one way to work with clients or build a business, or you don't have to niche down always. It's okay to try a lot of different things, offer a bunch of different things to clients. There's just not one answer to how to make this stuff.
And if that stresses you out, you want to investigate that and deal with it up front, because if you think there's one way to do it and you're just looking for that one way and then it doesn't work out, that can be very disappointing.
Yeah. You got a lot of pivots ahead. So
seriously.
Buckle up for the journey.
So what will you do when you get bored of everything that we just talked about? If you had to pivot, how do you go about that process? Like finding work you might like, finding niches you might like, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I really love about working with startups right now and specifically thought leadership is that I can't see it getting boring anytime soon. And there's just so many different, it's just these really complex people who have to be a little bit crazy in a good way to believe that their vision can turn into a super successful company and to not back down from that vision and build a whole team around it and fundraise around it. It does not get boring. And I feel like I'm along for that ride with them. In terms of if this were to no longer feel like the right fit for me, I don't know. Like I've definitely had times where I'm in a Slack community of alumni from past jobs, or I don't know, like I'm just talking to friends who are also freelancers, but maybe doing slightly different work or working with slightly different types of clients. And somebody just mentions, hey, I have someone who's looking for content support in whatever area. And there have definitely been times where I'm like, I might like that. And I just say, hey, me, like, I'd love an introduction. Let me see where this goes. I haven't done this before, and just feel it out. And so I'll probably just end up doing something like that and testing something, seeing how it feels, maybe incorporating it. Same way I decided that I wanted to work with startups. Just, oh, I love this client. I want more. But I'm still not a planner with career stuff. I've had so many twists and turns and pivots throughout my career that I'm just like, I'm just winging it. And most of the time, okay with that. And not to say I don't sometimes completely panic that I'm never going to get another client, but most of the time I'm just like, I'll figure it out.
We're leaning into the serendipity of having a network. That's not nothing.
Yeah. And that's what I prioritize more than anything, not the traditional, like, how can I generate more leads? I've tried that stuff. I always feel icky about it. It rarely works for me. Like email lead gen or LinkedIn lead gen, all that stuff. I have so fully leaned into just making friends with people who are in similar worlds or on similar journeys. And how can I refer work to them? How can I support them? How can we really build these friendships where we feel like we're each other's coworkers and we have each other's back? And that has given me the comfort of like, all right, if this doesn't work out or this gets bored, I have this group of amazing people who I can go back to and be like, can I talk this through with you? I'm feeling really stuck. This isn't the right direction. How should I be thinking about this? And a lot of them have been there. And that's amazing.
That question, how should I be thinking about this? That can get you so far. You have buddies in business.
Yeah. Make friends. That's my number one piece of business advice.
And we all hear your network is your net worth, stuff like that. And I think when we're new to business, we assume that means people we know will hire us. And that's not the only way a network can provide value. So literally just being around and then being around consistently and then reaching out to individual people and making friends, that is a way that a network can have value in the long term. It's more like a 2 to 5 year play, but yeah, I don't think it's just about getting hired straight out of your network.
No, and I think, you know, the more honest you're willing be about your challenges at this point, depending on the, know your audience, right? There's definitely different levels of friendship. I have the people where I'm a little bit less transparent about everything, but conversations around pricing or negotiating, or does anyone know somebody who's been through the similar situation who I could talk to? There are just so many valuable pieces of building that network of trusted peers who are also in this wild world of business ownership, or even in the corporate world. And you get that perspective from them, and they get the freelancer business owner perspective from you.
I think what I'm thinking of is social capital. And it's not that we're saying you would just go onto LinkedIn and announce to 300 people, like, help, I need, like, what should I do with my pricing? I'm lost. Like, I think both you and I have already invested in several communities. So we have smaller networks with people who are a bit more committed to this kind of work. And so there is some social capital. When you post about something, other people have an incentive and a relationship there where it would be worth it for them to take some time and respond, basically. And I have some groups like that too. And of course, I run one. So it's less about just go out in the world and be vulnerable and people will help you, but more like identify certain communities or certain people and try to actually create relationships with them. Because you need a little social capital to get a good answer to your question. I just want to caveat that.
Yeah. Don't post on LinkedIn and ask how to, you know, how much to charge for your early days.
Because then, like, just thousands of people see it and they move on, and there's just no, there's no grip there for them to invest in that relationship with you before they know you, before you know them.
Yeah.
I think I see people missing that sometimes.
Yeah. It's all like a lot of, there are some obvious things, but I think a lot of it is also just like trial and error, even just as much as figuring out the right type of client or right amount of work. What does capacity look as a freelancer? Where should I be spending my time? Where should I be building these relationships? How much should I invest into that? What are the right communities? Because if there's so many options out there, and if you try to be everywhere, or do everything, or take every piece of advice, you're going to end up with your head spinning really quickly.
Or if you go to a group of struggling freelancers and you ask struggling freelancers how to not be struggling, they probably aren't going to have any insights for you, right? Like, you can't, drowning people can't help other drowning people. So it's kind of like putting some standards in there for who you're going to listen to, like attaching yourself to an expert and following their people could be great. I just posted about that on LinkedIn, asking people who their most influential coaches were as they were growing their business, and got some great names. Like, of course, Carol Tice, Ed Gandia, Linda Formicelli, Danny Inney was another one. So there are people with, it's like successful freelancers follow in their wake, and you want to find some of those and then get in with those. And there's free networking, there's stuff that you have to pay for, but generally finding people who are making it work and then listening to their advice is a really good way to start.
Yeah, finding the right, I never had, I don't know if you, because you've had, I've generally been in like writing content related fields, and you really pivoted. So did you feel like you had mentors throughout your career, or do you feel like they came out once you really found your calling in the content space?
No, it's all mentors for me, all completely. Because the very first thing I did when I got that marketing job, man, I guess it started back when I was teaching, because I would follow Carol Tice and Linda Formicelli and started writing in Content Mills and figuring that whole thing out. And let me tell you, the delight of earning $15 from that first blog was like, that was electric. I celebrated that, which is wild. And then once I got an actual marketing job, I bought a product from Alexis Grant about how to build a social media strategy and just used that to do my job. So really from the beginning, I knew I needed to invest in some things and learn from things. But maybe just because I was an educator, so I'd already gotten a degree in teaching, so I knew if you want to do something new, you have to learn something new. And the best way to do that was with somebody's content.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you're teaching people.
Right? Yeah. Full circle. Yeah. Full circle. It took me 10 years to heal my teaching wounds and then be able to do that again. Because people can't throw rocks at you through the internet. That's the secret. When it's virtual, you're safe.
They can leave reviews, but it's also...
Yeah. But I don't have to read them. So that works out.
Exactly. Or you don't have to even allow them.
Yeah. And then I guess once I started really freelancing, I got to that 30 or 50K, maybe 89K part-time. And then Ed Gandia had like very straightforward, if you're making X, I can help you get to X. And so I jumped on that train. And then that's been probably one of my more formative mentors throughout all this. Like, why teach yourself? Why go it alone? Why hope it'll work out? That just doesn't make sense to me.
So my entire time in the corporate world, I was always the only one doing my job, my specific type of job within a company. Everyone was just so underwater that I always felt like I was largely alone. And I would look to and have some incredible managers who have helped in huge ways, but I never felt like I really had a mentor in the corporate world, to the point where like I looked into paying for somebody who can be a mentor. I didn't really know about the concept of coaches.
Yeah, executive coaches.
And then not long after, I decided to leave the corporate world and start my own business. All of these relationships that felt like this mix of like coaches, friends, mentors came out of the woodwork. And I look back 6 months in and was like, I don't know how this happened. Maybe I just attracted the right people who wanted me to succeed because I finally figured out what I wanted to do long term, because I finally leaned into, oh, maybe I am meant to be a business owner. I don't know. But it was just this, like, this level of support and connection, like cheerleading, that I didn't feel like I had the first decade plus of my career, that just all of a sudden that switched when I went out on my own.
Interesting. I think you have to be open to that, though, to see it happen. Because if you were committed to doing it your way or on your timeline, maybe their advice or their offers for help wouldn't have resonated. Maybe you would have been shut off to that.
Yeah. I think I was really hungry for feedback is also
interesting.
Part of it. Even as I started coming up with, how am I going to talk about my future company? I reached out to so many friends, people I had done smaller one-off freelance projects with, just anyone who I thought might be in my potential target audience. And like, how does this feel to you? What is your feedback? Here's what I think I'm going to focus on. Would you hire me? And I think that also came from being in those roles where I didn't get a lot of feedback for most of my career. Sophie, you're doing great. Because they didn't have a reference point. They worked in a completely different area of marketing or PR. And I would definitely get some feedback. But there were a lot of times where it was just like, you're doing great. It's like, I feel like I could be doing better. And I want someone to tell me that I could be doing better and challenge me to get better. So when I went out on my own, I was so hungry for that feedback and for people to challenge me and say, maybe that isn't the clearest way to talk about your business. Maybe that's not the best way to put together a proposal. And so I just really wanted to meet people who were willing to do that and were open to me doing the same for my experiences. And that's probably how it all came into place.
Do you feel like any part of you is tempted to take that as criticism? Did that feel like a reason not to do it early on? Or you just felt like all feedback was going to help you move forward with it?
That's a really good question. I think definitely college journalism and probably earlier on in my career in the corporate world, I would get a little crumbly with feedback.
That's super cute.
Yeah, I definitely would get scared. Like I turned off spell check on my computer once. I was in college and I had a MacBook, when it was really early, like white plastic MacBooks that, you know, and I didn't want to pay for Microsoft Word. So I downloaded the free, like whatever, OpenOffice, and somehow I turned off spell check. And I spelled the same word wrong like 5 times. And my journalism professor failed me on the paper and was like, come see me. Let me rewrite it. It was fine. He ended up actually giving me amazing advice about going into this field, journalism at the time. But I still remember that I would just anxiously pore over the AP style book for every assignment after that and question everything. And I just took that feedback so personally of, how could I have been stupid to turn on spell check and not catch it? How could I have spelled this word wrong so many times? And I'm never going to have a career as a respected journalist. And I mean, that wore off over time. But yeah, I probably did not lean into the feedback until I got a little bit farther in my career and realized that it's not the end of the world if somebody asks you.
Or if you legitimately make a mistake, it's not the end of the world because you spelled the words wrong. So it's not, this was a made up scenario, but also it's okay. And you can spell them correctly next time. That wasn't the end of the line.
Yeah. But I would very much, I was so afraid of making mistakes early on. Or if I made one, it would just be crippling. And I'd just be so scared that I would do it again. And what would people think about me? And what would that mean for the future of my career? I'm human. I know. Surprise. Yes. I've made plenty of mistakes with even client work that I just owned up to, and it's fine. I've never gotten fired, knock on wood. For people generally realize that you're a human and it's not the end of the world if something small happens, or you show up late to a call because you were distracted doing something for your kid or whatever. Like, life goes on.
Yeah.
It doesn't define you.
Yeah, and we need to remember that, because sometimes, maybe I've worked with some people who have had toxic work environments where those kind of things did cause big problems. But it's still like you have to take that agency back for yourself and decide it's okay. And that person was just off the rocker and doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a process.
Yes, an ongoing one.
Cool. This has been crazy awesome talking about like calling clients and figuring out your own working style. So thank you, Alyssa.